And thank you all for coming out on this very rainy and cold day this afternoon. You didn't have to come, but I really appreciate you coming out. And Marty mentioned that I was on the museum board, and I would just like to say that one of the things I admired very early on about Marty and the staff at the museum is that they are intentional about being inclusive of women, people of color, and other marginalized groups. Here at the museum, and I can say we don't wait for the Office of Diversity to do something. We don't wait for the Office of Multicultural Affairs to honor the Hispanic students here and the African American students and other groups that I'm probably missing. Dr. Allen and her staff and our board, we do our own programming. You don't have to tell us or drop us hints that we need to be inclusive. So let's give them a hand. Give us a hand for what we do. And thank you again for that nice introduction. As Dr. Allen mentioned, I've been teaching journalism for more than 25 years now. One of my favorite subjects is mass media history, which I have been teaching here at Arkansas State University since the early 2000s. In my presentation this afternoon, I want to try to do a couple of things. Of course, I'll give a brief overview of the history of the black press. And in order to talk about Arkansas, we must go back to the turn of the century and to the 1800s. So I'll do that. As a historian, you have to do your history. Okay. And then I'll conclude with some local history, and I'll talk about the impression that the black press, particularly black newspapers, had on me growing up in the East Arkansas Delta with no internet and no other visual images, positive images of African Americans. So I couldn't do a presentation without talking about also my fellow Arkansan, the late John H. Johnson, founder and publisher of Ebony Magazine. So I'm going to try to do all of that in this presentation tonight. Okay. The black press has been around, as I mentioned, in the United States since 1827. I think we were going to turn those lights off so we could see it better. And the gentlemen you see here are the Reverend Samuel Cornish on, I don't know, your left and my right, and Mr. John Russworm. Yeah, we're going to leave the bubbles on and just turn off the main lights. Thank you all. Okay. Okay, and I'm pretty sure everyone is up on that history. I mentioned that the black press has been around since 1827. And what that tells you is that there were black people publishing newspapers about 38 years before the slavery was abolished with the adoption of the 13th Amendment on the very last day of the year 1865. So there were freed people, and not only were African-American publishers had press and were advocating for the abolition of slavery, but there were also white abolitionist editors who were doing the same thing. So Samuel Cornish, who later became Reverend Cornish, was the editor of what's called the Freedom's Journal. He was born in Sussex County, Delaware, and raised in Philadelphia and New York City. Since both of his parents were free, African Americans, he was born free. And after graduating from the Free African School in Philadelphia, Cornish began training to become a Presbyterian minister and was ordained in 1822. Shortly afterward, he moved to New York City, where he organized the first black Presbyterian church in Manhattan. In addition to his duties as pastor, Cornish also became a journalist. He worked with fellow African-American John B. Russworm on my right, and they both founded, once again, the first African-American newspaper in the United States called Freedom's Journal. Cornish was the senior editor of the paper, while Russworm served as junior editor. The first issue appeared in New York City on Friday, March 16, 1827. After living in a world dominated by white media, Cornish and Russworm stated in their first editorial, I love this quote, it says, "We wish to plead our own cause. Too long have others spoken for us. Too long have the public been deceived by misrepresentations in things that concern us dearly. And that's March 16, 1827. This statement clearly sent a message about their intentions of publishing the news about African Americans without white bias. After working on the Freedom Journal for less than a year, Cornish stepped down as the senior editor and took a position as an agent for the New York Free African Schools. In 1829, Cornish was forced to return as an editor after Russ Wurm allowed the paper to decline and shift away from its original purpose of describing the cultural and economic progress of free blacks in the North. Upon his return, Cornish revived the paper and renamed it The Rights of All and maintained it for a year. As slaves, African Americans were forbidden to read, but after the Civil War, reading became one of the most treasured symbols of freedom. For a lot of people, black newspapers were an introduction to the power and the magic of the written word. And I volunteer, not as much as I used to, in public schools, and a lot of times I'll tutor first graders. And if you ever watch them when they're learning that they know words, it's so exciting. So I imagine this is how the recently freed people felt here. As you can see, there are adults and children all mixed together, learning how to read. And that was a big deal back then, going from not being able to, and then all of a sudden you can read. So, between the end of the Civil War and the turn of the century, more than 500 black newspapers began publication. Many of these papers borrowed printing presses from African American churches, so this meant that the same machines that produced programs for Sunday services were printing the news. For the most part, these papers lasted only a short time, but the papers appeared across the country in cities such as Indianapolis, Omaha, Mobile, San Francisco, and they also appeared in smaller towns such as Galveston, Texas, Coffeeville, Kansas, and of course, Little Rock and my very own Helena, Arkansas. And when you see the list of papers in Helena, I didn't know any of this until I started doing this research for this. They were really publishing back then in the 1800s. Okay, so the first paper in Arkansas was the Arkansas Freeman. It began publication on August 21st, 1869, and it focused on the black community. Its publisher was the Reverend Tabbs Gross, an ex-slave from Germantown, Kentucky, although some documents say he was from Cincinnati. But he did come from the outside. He was an ex-slave, and he came here and started this paper in Little Rock. Reverend Gross believed that black citizens in the state needed, and I quote, a faithful and reliable newspaper devoted particularly to their interests and conducted and controlled by men of their own race and color, unquote. My nephew and my great nephew saying hi. I don't know why, but okay. As you might guess, white newspaper publishers were not happy with the introduction of the Arkansas Freeman. In fact, research indicates that they were outraged. For example, the Daily Arkansas Gazette wrote in an editorial that while a black newspaper would be second only to the Emancipation Proclamation for Arkansans of African descent, the race was too illiterate and naive to handle such a challenge. Subscriptions for the Arkansas Freeman began 2 months before it was actually published. Around the same time, a lot of black people were having meetings with whites who discouraged them from associating with Reverend Gross. After all, Gross was not only an editor, but he was also an entrepreneur. And when I was doing some reading, I found out that he eventually became an attorney, and he did a lot of suing of people. He sued. If you read about black lawyers and his name comes up, he's on some kind of lawsuit. Well, anyway, African Americans who were against the Arkansas Freeman and Reverend Gross believed that the Arkansas Freeman could actually land them back in slavery. Still, despite this opposition, the bribery, and other assaults on his character, Gross managed to publish the first issue of the Arkansas Freeman with the motto of, and I quote, devoted to the interests of the colored people of Arkansas, unquote. Each issue of the Arkansas Freeman urged blacks to do more for the betterment of black people. Gross encouraged them to seek political positions at the local and state level. He warned readers about how employers could cheat them with their wages and salaries. He spoke against Chinese immigration because he thought it took job opportunities from black people. And he also spoke out strongly against convict labor. And if you know anything about convict labor, you know that it was a new form of slavery where the government actually made money after a lot of, especially black men, were in prison for a lot of really menial, well, I guess every crime is bad, but they would steal 5 chickens and be locked up for years, especially around election time. So, but that was what was happening, and it was just convict labor. You become a prisoner, and they rent you out to do the work. So it was a new form of slavery. So in December 1869, just 4 months after the start of the publication, Tabb suddenly closed down the Freeman and went to Memphis, where he attempted to raise funds for the paper. And once again, if you read about him, and there are no pictures of this gentleman anywhere, but if you read more about some of his dealings, he promoted, I call him concerts, the blind musician, Blind Tom, whatever. He promoted that concert. He sued some people because he thought he got a bad deal with that. But anyway, while he was away in Memphis, another gentleman, James Akers, who was a news correspondent from the Cincinnati Commercial, moved to Little Rock and just restarted the paper. So Akers claimed he had purchased the paper from Gross in Memphis. But Gross returned to Little Rock 2 months later and sued Akers for damages. He also sued the owners and publishers of the Republican, the white newspaper that he had had trouble with when he first started the paper. He sued the Republican paper for making false charges against him while he was away in Memphis. And even though none of the allegations were true, of course, the case was dismissed. So by the summer of 1870, the Arkansas Freeman, it stopped publishing. And Gross did this mainly because of the divisions within the Republican Party. And as I mentioned, he did, I don't know about what time he became an attorney, but if you read about the history of black lawyers in the state of Arkansas, you will see his name listed with some of the other greats. So even though the Freeman lasted only about a year, I feel like it paved the way for more than the other 100 black news publications that will follow in the years to come. Two historians, Dan Littlefield Jr. and Patricia McGraw, had this to say about the Freeman, and I quote, "Its very destruction by the local power structure it had attacked proved that the black press could be a powerful dissenting voice which had to be dealt with by those in power," unquote. So the Freeman paved the way for this more than 100 black publications that will follow. And here at ASU, we have copies of some of those papers that followed the Freeman in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. And our database, here's one, the Arkansas Mansion. In the top left corner, you see the issues that we have in our holdings. In the middle of the page, 1880 to 1886, that's another document that gives the actual dates that we have record of it being published. Okay, next slide. This is the Pine Bluff Weekly Herald. In our holdings, we have only one issue, and this database is constantly being updated. In the middle of the page, we see that it lasted roughly 7 years, and it was a Saturday publication. Next. And this is the American Guide, also out of Little Rock. It published from 1889 to 1905. It was a Saturday publication. So this is what we have in our database here, and there's some more that I'll show you later. Probably the most famous black newspaper, or the one that many of us are most familiar with, is the State Press. This week, the weekly Arkansas State Press newspaper was founded in Little Rock in 1941 by civil rights pioneers Lucius Christopher, or L.C. Bates, and Daisy Gatson Bates. There's Mr. Bates on the left, and there's Mrs. Bates on the right. The State Press was modeled after the Chicago Defender and other Northern African-American publications of the era, such as The Crisis, which is a magazine of the National Association of Colored People. The State Press was concerned mainly with advocating for causes that concern black people. The front page often featured articles and editorials about civil rights. And there's an issue. I believe that is the first issue we have in our holdings. I'm not sure if it's the very first. But the front page, as I mentioned, featured articles and editorials about civil rights. Throughout its 18-year existence, the State Press was the largest statewide African-American newspaper in Arkansas. And like any newspaper, newspapers, we teach in journalism that newspapers play a role in helping us keep history or keep history. This slide is, I wanted to say a little bit about it. I have a friend who is a descendant of this gentleman who was murdered, George Miller. If you know anything about Helena, you know that we have what's called Miller Junior High School. They used to, Junior High, which is now an elementary school, but it used to be the Black High School, so it has evolved. But anyway, Kyle, Dr. Kyle Miller, a friend of mine, he's one of the great-great-grandsons of this family, and I was telling him about, I sent him an email, I said, Kyle, I was just reading us in the archives of the State Press, and I found out that Dan Miller was murdered at your grandma's theater. His grandmother owned the first Black theater, and I emailed, he texted me back, and he said, you know, Dad always talked about that, but we just never could verify when it happened. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, when I go back in the archives, when I get some time, I'll send you the actual article. So this is the October 3rd, 1941 issue, and it showed, and it gives an account of that murder. The Miller family in Arkansas, when I was growing up, Dr. Miller was the only Black doctor in town, medical doctor. His grandmother, I believe, she owned real estate. She was like the Oprah Winfrey of the back in the day. And she owned the first and only Black theater that we ever had in Helena. And this is what happened to her. I want to say he's her brother. He was at the theater and somebody, and in this article they call the man a thug, came up and they said he was parading. The article says he was parading as a minister. And he went to the back. He gave him a free ticket, and he just shot him in the head and killed him. And some people wrestled him down. And Kyle told me that, he said, my grandfather worked very hard to make sure he got the death penalty. So I don't know if his grandfather is a nephew or what, but my family never talked about this murder either. So I thought, and I've already sent him a copy of this, so because he said they never could verify what his dad was talking about, but there's the verification. Once again, newspapers help us record history. Okay, so back to the state press. There's Ms. Bates and Mr. Bates. I call this slide the Bates at Work. And so the State Press always stood behind the leadership of the national policies of the NAACP. And if you know anything about Ms. Bates, she was the state president at one time. The State Press became a militant supporter of racial integration of the public schools during the 1950s. And it had an editorial stance that put it at odds not only with white people in Arkansas, but also many African Americans. And what does that sound like? The same problem that I believe Reverend Gross was having. Blacks were suspicious, and they couldn't get on board with the paper. So Ms. Bates and Mr. Bates had that same problem. They didn't want to align themselves with the paper. On May, just a few facts about the State Press. On May 21st, 1954, 4 days after the historic Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas decision, which declared an end to racial segregation in public schools, the State Press published an editorial that stated the following, and I quote, "We feel that the proper approach would be for the leaders among the Negro race, not clabbermouths, Uncle Toms, or grinning appeasers, to get together and counsel with the school heads," unquote. Again, people in white communities were not the only people who felt that the time was not yet right for school integration. There were some blacks who felt the same way. Whatever the case, the State Press took on both groups, and for the next 5 years until its demise in 1959, the State Press was the sole newspaper in Arkansas to demand an immediate end to segregated schools. The uncompromising stance during the Little Rock desegregation crisis in 1957 resulted in a boycott by white advertisers. Actually, this was the second boycott. And so, although the State Press received direct financial support from the National Office of the NAACP and from NAACP organizations and other groups and individuals throughout the country, this boycott, as well as intimidation of black news carriers, proved fatal. And so the last issue was published on October 29th, 1959. This is a copy of the last issue. Daisy Bates attempted to revive the state press in 1984 after the death of her husband, L.C. And there he is. Even though the paper had ended, this is about 10 years later, he is still advocating for justice. This is a photo of him at an Arkansas Senate and House hearing. She tried to revive it in 1984, but the attempt was financially unsuccessful, and she ended up selling her interest in the paper in 1988 to Daryl Lunnon and Janice Kearney Lunnon, who continued to publish for about 8 more years, or until 1997. And you know, as I was doing research, there's Ms. Kearney and Mrs. Bates. You know, Janice taught here for about a year, about seven years ago, I believe. But anyway, when I was doing research, I always wondered why I never heard about the Arkansas the state press growing up, because my mother was the kind who had magazines in the house. And then I looked at the years, I said, they stopped publishing in 59, I wasn't born. And then when they tried to revive it, it was the year that I graduated from Arkansas State with my bachelor's, so that's how I missed it. Because I thought, how did I miss this? My mother was the kind of person, I was reading Ebony and Jet magazines from third grade on until I was well into adulthood. I can tell you about congressmen, congresswomen, everything, but I was like, where was the state press thing? I meant to ask my dad last night, do you remember the state press? Because when they did in 1957, he was in high school, getting ready to finish high school. He said, did they close his school? I've got to get that history straight. Talk to him more and interview him. So other newspapers that follow the state press, our black newspaper database here at ASU has copies of the other newspapers that follow the state press. And one of those papers was the Southern Mediator Journal. We have two issues in our holdings, but it started in 1938. And to date, the book that I got this out of was published in 1975, so I don't know when it was not published, and that's why we said date, because we know it's published through 1975, but the book has not been updated. Okay, so you may wonder, were there any other black newspapers in the Delta or here in Northeast Arkansas? So the book that I was telling you about, well, I'll talk about our black newspaper database here at Arkansas. At ASU has copies of one of the more recent black newspapers that was published in the Delta. In fact, it was published in Forest City, Arkansas, and that is Homeland. I volunteered and helped them one weekend. I loved Homeland. It came out once a week, and it published, looks like about 8, maybe 9 years. We have 90 issues in our archives. It was published right there in Forest City. So the book that I was telling you about is called Black Newspapers, 1869 to 1975, A Checklist by Amanda Saar. It lists several newspapers published during this 106-year period. And I'll just show you some lists. What you see in red are the towns that are near here. We have one in Earl, one in Jericho, published in the early 1900s. One in Marion, and then there's two in West Memphis, and this is just up through 1975. And then we have two in Wynn, next slide. Mariana had three, that's Lee County, Mississippi County, Osceola had one, and my little birth town of Holly Grove, population 747, had two. And this is Helena. I don't know what was going on in Helena. Dr. Dugan, what were they doing down there? But they say 16 issues. And the ones in purple, those are my favorite titles. Arkansas Mule, Jacob's Friend, People's Friend. I just love those titles. And I'm thinking that the recorder or Baptist recorder was published by Centennial Church. If you know anything about historic Centennial Church, that church was pastored for several years. Do you know how many years, Bill? By Reverend...
Not exactly.
Yeah.
It was around the turn of the century.
Yeah, so he also started at Arkansas Baptist College. He started the National Baptist Convention, which is big, and the Missionary Baptist Church Association. So I'm pretty sure he was responsible for those years of the Arkansas, of the Southern, Baptist Recorder, those years.
I think he was elected in 1892 or 93, and he passed until 1925.
Okay, yeah, he was there for quite a while, and Reverend E.C. Morris, that's it, the great E.C. Morris. Okay, all right then. Here's another slide. This is St. Francis County down in the Forest City area. What is that, about 7? And then Woodruff County, Augusta, we have one issue. So yes, there were black papers, and someone asked me the other day, were there any in Jonesboro? And that's what made me go and start counting to see what this book documented. Up through 1975, there were, according to this research, and she did a really good job, I mean, she looked at insurance records, other newspapers, but there are none listed for Craighead County. The closest is, did I say Newport? I think Wynn is on the list maybe. Did I show Wynn? Okay. Okay, so like I said, I couldn't do a talk like this without talking about the contributions of magazine publishers. And I think I mentioned that I grew up around Ebony and being in a household with Ebony and Jet magazine. So, magazines by and for African Americans. What you see here is a magazine that I used to write for and I was a consultant for when we first started in January 2007. As you can see, we recently stopped publishing in April 2013. My colleague, Professor Sandra Combs, was a great contributor also. She published, helped us also. Our very own Dr. Lonnie R. Williams was the chief editor, and I think he was the chief everything. He sold ads. He really held it together as long as he could, and I have hopes that maybe we will start it up again. So that is the African American Perspectives magazine, just two copies, one of my favorite with the little girl praying, and then with the black Union soldiers, I believe in Helena. That's a replica of a photo we took in Helena. Okay. And then there's my hero when I was growing up, the great late, my fellow Arkansan John H. Johnson, born in Arkansas City, loved school. He repeated the eighth grade because there were no more grades. He wanted to go to a high school so badly. And he and his family, I believe his dad had already died. They moved to Chicago, and he got a chance to go to high school and went, I believe he enrolled in DuSable High School. So he got a chance to finish high school. And that's where he lived the rest of his life. He started Negro Digest first because he was working at an insurance company, and they let him put together newsletters, and he just... the publishing bug bit him, and he started publishing his own magazine. Okay, next. So I mentioned that I grew up in a community, or really in a state, where I think we have yet to elect an African American to Congress or the U.S. Senate in the state of Arkansas. I think we're the last state that is yet to do that. Mississippi has done it. Alabama, Georgia, but Arkansas still has never elected anyone of African-American descent to Congress or to the U.S. Senate. But this issue is 1969. I still saw black people being congresswomen and congressmen because of this publication, reading it from a child all the way up until I was well into adulthood. So thankful to Mr. Johnson for this contribution because, like I said, it opened my eyes in rural, well, all of Arkansas is rural, but the Delta, it just showed me a world that I could reach for. I couldn't necessarily, it wasn't happening around me, but I could still see it just reading this magazine. Next. That's Julian Bond. I like this issue because it says Black America's choice for president. And we think that the first black person who tried to run was the Reverend Jesse Jackson, but people were touting Congressman, I believe he was a congressman, Julian Bond before then. And that's 1971. Okay, next. Same thing with mayors. I know we have had two or three African-American mayors in Helena and in several communities in the East Arkansas Delta, but when I was growing up, I didn't see that. But I would see Mayor Harold, no, that's Mayor Tom Bradley from L.A. in this magazine all the time. So at this time, I'm around 11 when this issue is out, fifth grade, and I have my quote is, my slogan here is, Lily Fears, age 11, just finished fifth grade, learns black people are mayors too. Wow. Okay, next. Okay, and then when this lady, I still like to meet her, Congresswoman Yvonne Braithwaite Burke. She was elected to Congress out of the state of California when I was about 12, and she had a newborn baby too while she was in office, I believe. So how did I learn about this? The black press. Okay, next. And so I owe all that to the contributions of, once again, the late John H. Johnson. When I was a student here at Arkansas State, when I first got here, I transferred from a two-year college. I was struggling with, should I major in broadcasting or print? And do you know I had the nerve to write him a letter and get his advice? And he wrote me back. But years later, my cousin, who worked for Fashion Fair, the cosmetics division of Johnson & Johnson, she said that, girl, don't you know his secretary wrote that? But here I am, a confused 20-year-old, and I needed to know what to do. I wrote Mr. Johnson. I still have that letter. And in my heart, he wrote me back. She said he didn't. But I will always believe he wrote me. Yes, he did. I have the stationery, the actual letter, and he gave me all the scenarios. It was a nice letter. He had that beautiful signature. Okay, next slide. Okay. So I'm reading the Ebony magazine. I'm being influenced by what I read. I'm 13, and I decide to publish myself in seventh grade. So I published three books in a series. It was a health project for a PE class, and I could have done some other things, but I just decided I would publish my first. I don't know which one was first, but I'm 13, sitting in seventh grade, and you can see my teacher was very, I knew she would be impressed. When I put this thing together, I knew it was great. So I knew it was some of my best work. I can see myself with my scissors and tape cutting out my pictures. And so my first in the series, I don't know if it's a book, a magazine, or what, but it's called The Woman and the Things in Her Life. Next. Okay, so by now, as you can see, I'm showing signs that of graphic design. Volume 1, number 2 is called VD, Will It Catch You or Will You Catch It? V, and the subtitle, V is for very, D is for dangerous. And when I show my college students this, and it'll get stuck with one person, I'm telling them to pass it around. They just sit there, they're like, Dr. Fears, you were pretty deep at 13. So that's the second in the series. And my final series in this series was, this is called, this is when I started signing. I used to sign my name editor quite a bit. I got that from John Johnson. In the opening, when you open Ebony, he would write a letter and sign his name and then editor. So this one is called Your Appearance. And as you see, I made 100 on all of them. I'm really, and at the bottom, it says, oh, I'm doing credits now. Cover front. Y'all are laughing. I was sick. Okay, the credit at the bottom says cover photo, Natalie Cole or something like that. So I didn't know I was picking up all of this just reading Ebony and Jet, but I mean, that's the impression it made on me. So I always say that I was just a good organizer. I like to organize information, but these are my first publications as a seventh grader. And I meant to put a slide of, it would be 6 years later before I actually worked for a newspaper, and that was at my junior college in Helena. And I would write so much, sometimes I would write probably 90% of the issue. I'd do 90% of the stories. I mean, it was serious. I was really intense. So, in sum, I thought I would leave with, you know, the last publisher, and that's me. In sum, you might ask whether the black press is significant. Maybe you don't ask that. After all, we have not had a consistent black newspaper in the state of Arkansas for some years now. To that question, I say yes. The black press is still significant in black America and in America in general. As I've demonstrated some this afternoon, the black press, like the mainstream press, offers a historical record of what is happening in our world. And this record is a base for knowledge and can even be a catalyst for change. The black press can also empower us to act, and it also challenges the powers that be to move in a positive direction. So in sum, I salute all of the publishers who make up this great institution that we call the black press. I salute Reverend Cornish and Mr. John Russworm for laying the foundation for the black press 38 years before slavery was abolished. That effort alone was a step toward the abolition of slavery. I also salute the Reverend Tabs Gross, who left Kentucky or Cincinnati and came to Arkansas to start the first black newspaper in 1869. Although he published just 1 year, he showed Arkansas that newly freed people appreciated their new right to learn to read and to go to school, to start and own businesses, and demand a fair wage when they work for whites. I salute all the editors and publishers in Arkansas, in my hometown of Helena, and in my tiny birth town of Holly Grove, who started some of the more than 100 papers in Arkansas that followed Freedom's Journal and the Arkansas Freeman. I also salute Mr. L.C. and Mrs. Daisy Bates for starting the state press and using it to advance the agenda of the NAACP, especially the integration of public schools. Last but not least, I salute my fellow Arkansans, the late John H. Johnson, for stepping out on faith more than 75 years ago, mortgaging his mother's furniture so he could start Negro Digest, the forerunner to Ebony and Jet magazine. And I also salute our very own Dr. Lonnie Williams, for his effort in publishing the African American Perspectives magazine. The Reverend Samuel Cornish and Mr. John Russworm said it best, and I quote again, "We wish to plead our own cause. Too long have others spoken for us. Too long have the public been deceived by misrepresentations and things that concern us dearly. May we continue to do what we can today to exercise our First Amendment right of speaking our own cause by using the modern technologies that allow us to do so. May we find ways to support existing black media, radio stations, magazines, bloggers, and microbloggers. Indeed, this is how we will continue to plead our cause. Thank you."